is Sunday, May 30th, 2010, and today we have a special program. We are very pleased and honored to have as our guest Greta Berlin. Greta Berlin.
Well, thank you. First of all, I'd say thank you for asking me to be on the program. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Greta is a member and major organizer with the Freedom Gaza movement, as well as a member and major organizer of the Freedom Flotilla, which is sailing toward Gaza as we speak. The Israeli government has said that it will do everything to prevent the flotilla from reaching Gaza, including violence. As we say here, as of now anyway, there is no indication that the Israelis have boarded the ships. So, Greta, good morning, and thank you for being our guest. Could you tell us what is going on right now?
Certainly. First of all, I'm in Cyprus, so I don't know how many hours ahead of you I am, maybe six. And we've just gotten confirmation from some of the organizers who are on the flotilla that they are planning on leaving they're in international waters right off the coast of Lebanon. So they're not anywhere close to Gaza yet. We have spent the last two or three days trying to get all the boats to get to the flotilla, and we have six that are going, and they should be leaving shortly. They should be leaving sometime within the next hour. And they are going, it'll take them 19 hours. Take them 19 hours to get from off the coast of Lebanon down to what we call the 30-mile line that Israel draws in the sand, or I guess in the sea, where they are threatening to stop us. And so that will take about 19 hours to get there, because the slowest boat is 8 miles an hour, and we all have to go at the slowest pace.
Yes, yes, I see. You've had some difficulties with the boats. There are two boats, I think, that have had mechanical problems of a suspicious nature. Do you suspect that there was some sabotage?
Israel made it very clear a couple of weeks ago that they would do everything that they could to stop the boats before we even got organized as a flotilla. And they said that they would try to stop them individually. Well, of course, we all thought as organizers that they might want to do something violent to the boats, but they didn't really need to do that. They can mess with the steering column. They can put a small nick in the hydraulic fuel. All of those things will take the boats out of commission. Our two boats, we've got two, Challenger 1 and Challenger 2, ended up getting mechanical problems at exactly the same time, and that was 3:30 in the afternoon on Friday afternoon, while we were off the coast of Cyprus. And I find that suspicious, for sure. I mean, we're not going to say anything until we have a good analysis of what has happened to both of them. Challenger 1, which is the larger of the two boats, it's a yacht, was fixed yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And we asked the flotilla to please wait for one more day so that we could load our passengers onto that boat and then take it out to the flotilla. And that's why the flotilla has been delayed for a day. Okay. They waited for us. And we got there at about 2:30 in the morning this morning. So they waited. I mean, they were wonderful. They waited for us and said, yes, we will wait. It's more important that we all go to Gaza together. And I think that they're probably going to begin to leave at 2 o'clock this afternoon.
Mm, I see. And when you were in Cyprus, what happened to the Cypriot promise to let you use their ports and to send the ships out?
We didn't have a promise from the Cypriot government to use their ports. In fact, we made it very clear that we would not use their ports. They've been very good to us when we left the last 8 times, and we have left from the Cypriot ports. I know that they are under pressure from the United States, and they're under pressure from Israel. And so last year they said, you can never leave from our ports again. And we said, fine, we would honor that commitment. We had a Greek partner who came to Cyprus about 2 months ago, and he said, if we can make an arrangement to load the members of parliament and the high-profile people in Cyprus, because it's essentially only about 18 or 19 hours from Cyprus to Gaza. Mm-hmm. And we do it under the radar. We don't let anybody know. We don't let the media know that we are here. Will that be okay? And the Cyprus government said yes. But you cannot bring your boats into port. We said, okay, we will hire a boat. We will put everybody on board, and we will take them past the 12-mile limit. That's the territorial waters. And we will board the boats outside the territorial waters of Cyprus. When we got ready to do that on Friday,
yes,
the police and the Navy or whatever it is that Cyprus has stopped us. They stopped us Friday morning, and we don't know whether it was a setup. Cyprus has very clearly said in their news media that we damage their relationship with Israel. They keep saying that they did not bow to Israeli pressure. Yeah, but then they still didn't let us go. So we've had to spend the last 2 days trying to find a way to get our passengers on board the boats and then on to the flotilla, which we have done.
Hmm. Well, that's quite an achievement. But they also said that they were struggling for their own survival.
Yes, that's what they say. It's quite interesting that they for 2 years they said that we could leave from this port, and then they suddenly said they are struggling for their survival. I know I live in Europe, so I know that Europe is struggling economically. But I think what really happened is that Israel made a deal with the Greek Cypriots, and they said, we have 2 charter boats that come to northern part of Cyprus twice a week. And so instead of going to the northern part of Cyprus, that's the Turkish side, we will make a deal with you that if you don't let these boats go out, we will send our charter boats to Cyprus and send them to Greek Cyprus. And that's exactly what has happened over the last year. That's exactly what has happened. So I would say that principles have given way to economics, and they have decided that we're not worth it. In which case, they've also decided that somehow the fight for justice for Palestine isn't worth it either.
Yes, it's always put on hold.
Yes, always. 62 years it's been put on hold. my entire lifetime has been put on hold, and then the lifetime of almost anybody who has been born after World War II. And I think that I understand that Cyprus has difficulties, and I understand that they tried to figure out how to prevent us from going. But and we abided by that. The thing that made us so angry is that we abided by their rule. We said, okay, we will follow your law, even if we think it's kind of stupid that we can't leave. But they had no right to stop a boat that was loaded with people that was going outside of their limits. Because once countries are going to start doing that, then what's to prevent any country from telling anybody, you can't get on a boat? Oh, gee, you can't go sailing today because you're going to go past our territorial limits. This is a horrible precedent. And unfortunately, the precedent has been established by Cyprus.
Of all places.
It's an island, you know, it's occupied. The reason that Cyprus has been so helpful to us is because they know what occupation is. They've been occupied on the northern side. I don't know whether they're angry at us because one of our partners is Turkish. You know, the Turkish organization, IHH, is one of our partners. But one of our other partners is Greek. So if the Greeks and the Turks can get along enough to put boats into a flotilla to send to Palestine, then the Cypriots should have gone along with it as well.
Sure. Could you tell us a little bit about what the boats are carrying?
Well, we've got six boats now. One of our boats was completely disabled. One of the things I want everybody in the United States to hear, because I think this is really important for us as Americans, we are always the last person to board the ship, so to speak, and nobody knows very much about what really happens in Palestine. But our two boats, our two yachts, are flagged with the American flag. We're sailing Challenger 1 into the port of Gaza with an American flag. It's going to be fascinating to find out what the United States is going to do about this. What are they going to do about this? These are flagged from the country of the country that enables Israel to do this. So are they going to do anything if the Israelis attack American citizens and other citizens and a boat that is flagged in the United States? It's going to be very interesting. And we did that on purpose, of course. I mean, we try very carefully to think strategically what's the best thing to do. So we now have six boats that are going. On those six boats is about 10,000 tons of supplies that are going to go to Gaza. Those supplies are all of the supplies that Israel refuses to allow into Gaza. I know Israel gets out their little PR mechanism and they spin their little wheels and they say, well, the people in Gaza don't need this because we bring all these trucks of supplies in. But the only supplies that Israel allows into Gaza are 81 items, and they're mostly food items and some medicines. Gaza needs supplies to rebuild. And Israel devastated the economy of Gaza back in 2009, in January of 2009. We're taking in cement and water purification systems and prefab homes, 20 tons of paper. Israel doesn't even allow paper into Gaza so that nobody can print their school books. We're taking in 2 tons of athletic equipment, because that's not allowed into Gaza either. So we have footballs and basketballs and football jerseys, all donated by the people in Ireland for the people of Gaza. None of these supplies, none of these items have ever been allowed into Gaza since 2007. And that's what we're trying to do. We are not trying to deliver humanitarian supplies. We're trying to break the blockade.
And that is an important difference.
It's an important difference because what Israel will say and has been saying is, well, you bring all of the supplies into Ashdod and we'll deliver them. No, they won't. And why should they have to? Why should the people of Gaza have to depend on Israel and Egypt for a handout? The people of Gaza are perfectly capable of taking care of themselves if given the opportunity, just like any of us. They want the opportunity to rebuild their lives and to go to school and to be able to leave and come back to their country. They want the ability to be able to fish and to farm. And all of those things have been taken away from them by Israel. And so we say over and over again that we are not on a humanitarian mission. We are on a mission to break the siege of Gaza.
Quite so. The American government, unfortunately, will not do anything. If Israel should decide to attack the boats carrying the American flag and attack the passengers, it will not do anything. The American government does not do anything for its people, especially in Israel.
Well, that's true, but governments never do anything. I mean, if governments were doing what they were supposed to be doing, we wouldn't have to do this at all. At the end of Operation Cast Lead, governments around the world pledged $4.5 billion to rebuild Gaza. Not one penny of that has gotten into Gaza. So when governments fail, it's really up to us, the people, the civilians, to do something about it, because actually we are the government. I mean, we need to remember to take that back. We need to take the governments back and make them about the people to begin with, because governments are bureaucracies that aren't going to do anything to shake up anything. So this is why this is a civilian movement. You're absolutely right. The government of the United States isn't going to do anything. But that doesn't prevent the people of the United States from being outraged over what is happening to the Palestinians. And this is beginning to happen. People are finally beginning to recognize what Israel has been doing to the Palestinians since 1948. And that's an encouragement for us. I mean, we have had in the last 2 days, as the flotilla began to get going, we have had dozens news outlets in the United States finally calling us and asking us for the story, CNN and Fox News and the New York Times, outlets that have never paid any attention to the Palestinians or to what we've been doing, and we've been doing it for 2 years. And frankly, that I find that very encouraging. We've shown up on the Huffington Post. We've shown up on the Drudge Report. Those are extremely important for Americans to learn. Americans aren't stupid. We're just ignorant. And when we learn about what has happened, I think we tend to get very outraged that we have been lied to. I have high hopes for Americans, not for the American government, but for Americans in general.
Yeah, I'm surprised when you mentioned that CNN and other outlets, because I haven't seen a thing on the mainstream media. Nothing.
The New York Times has run two articles already about the flotilla. The Huffington Post has run at least one article. The Drudge Report has run two or three articles. CNN is running a scroll on the bottom, and they call me maybe two or three times a day now and ask for an update. I do think that they're going to cover this. I don't think that they have any choice. I've had CNN in Jerusalem, and this is what's going to happen. CNN in Jerusalem, the BBC in Jerusalem, the AP, the Reuters, they're all calling us out of their Jerusalem offices. If this story gets big enough, it'll be covered in the United States. It will be.
I hope so. I certainly hope so.
Well, when the New York Times... when the New York Times runs an article and misquotes me, I know I have arrived. Because they totally misquoted me, and I thought, okay, well, I'm not going to say anything. I'm just happy that they're talking about the flotilla. So they are beginning to do that. The Washington Post has called us. Print is probably doing a better job than television is doing at the moment. But I am encouraged. I mean, I am an American. I feel personally very many times responsible for the fact that our government pays for this, what I call slow-motion genocide of the Palestinians. And I do think that Americans are beginning to wake up, and I don't think that Americans want this to be happening in their name. I honestly don't. And it may take a while, but I do see that there will not be an Israel the way it is now in the next few years. Israel is not going to survive as an apartheid state. That doesn't mean that it's going to be easy or it's going to be simple. It will not. But it will eventually be a state for all of its people.
Certainly. Let's hope so. Let me see. What else can you tell us about the flotilla?
Well, the flotilla has 700 people who are going, a little bit more than 700 people. Mm-hmm. And most of the passengers are on this big Turkish passenger boat that has been purchased by what they call IHH. It's a big Turkish humanitarian organization.
Yes.
They also have an Algerian boat that was loaded by the organization, and I think another boat that was funded by Kuwait. So they ended up with two cargo ships. We have a cargo ship called the Rachel Corrie, and then there's a Greek and Swedish cargo ship, and there are also people on board all of those ships as well. You can watch the streaming video. For anybody who really wants to watch this, there are two great websites people can watch. One is just IHH. They just have to Google IHH, and you will find their website come up right away, and you can see the streaming video. You can see the boats. You can see the passengers who are on board the boat.
Yes.
The other one is ours, which is called witnessgaza.com. And we, although our streaming isn't live, We are doing interviews, and we are doing backgrounders and all kinds of video short programs, and then we upload them two or three times a day so people can see what's going on. I know that our videographer right now is working on one right now, and then you can also watch all of our Twitter accounts. And the other thing that we have on our website is you can follow the boat's progress. We have something called a spot locator, and you can see exactly where the boats are. You can see that where the boats came, many of the boats came down the coast from from Greece came around the side of Cyprus. Now they're over by Lebanon. And when they start going, that spot locator will show you where they are about once an hour. So it's fun to watch because you can really get involved. You can get involved and you can watch. I have a hunch that most of us, certainly here in Cyprus, are not going to be sleeping much tonight. I don't think I've slept much, actually, for the last two nights. Although I'm not on board the boat, and I was one of the co-founders of Free Gaza, I was on the very first voyage, so I know what it's like, and I know what it's like to have your satellite reception jammed and to have the Israeli warships hovering around behind you. I know what that's like because I was there myself. But for the two or three of us who are trying to run this, we're in the office. Our friends are on these boats. We know these people. Many of these people we have known for years. So it's important for all of the people who are listening to me today in your area to go to those websites and to watch the streaming video and to really get involved in it because this is a people's movement. The Palestinians have actually started a people's movement that I think is really going to be highly, highly successful.
Mm. Well, what is your website again?
It's witnessgaza.com.
Witnessgaza.com. Yeah.
And the Turkish one is just IHH. If you just Google IHH, it'll take you straight to their website, and you can see the streaming video that is streaming live right now.
Great, great. You have some members of parliament. I think I saw at least one German member of parliament,
we have a lot of members of parliament. We have three Germans, and we have a Swedish member of parliament. We have a couple of Belgian members of parliament. There are members of parliament. There are two members of the Knesset, for example, Israeli-Palestinians who are on board, who are taking the biggest risk of all, because when they go back to Israel, they're likely to be arrested. They take a huge risk. The rest of us don't have the kind of risk that they have decided they want to take. We have members of parliament from around the Arab world, members of parliament from Greece who are on board. I don't know what the total count is, but I know that there's probably 30 or 40 members of parliament who are extremely supportive. I just saw this morning that there are members of parliament from Algeria, for example, who are on board the IHH ship.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really exciting because you're beginning to get politicians involved, politicians who feel a certain responsibility that they also need to let their government know that the treatment of the Palestinians cannot continue the way it is.
Now, the EU, the European Union, I guess, has let out a statement.
Surprisingly enough, we are continuously shocked. Margaret Ashton, I think, is one of the members of the EU. They put out a relatively tepid endorsement, but it's better. I mean, it's certainly better than we expected. There have been UN agencies, Amnesty International. We've gotten endorsements from around the world. But when the EU puts out a statement that says to Israel, do not harm our citizens and let this flotilla pass peacefully, it makes Israel look like the thug that it really is. I mean, Israel is going to send out its warships. They're saying this morning they're going to send out their warships and they're going to point their guns at us. We're civilians. We're going to stand in front of them in blue jeans. I mean, the world has got to see how insane Israel really is.
Yes.
And I'm actually hoping that this is going to be one of the final blows for Israeli militarism, because you can't do that to a group of people who are doing their best to help another group of people and then stand in front of us with your warships or board us with your commandos. It's insane, and it's time that the world started to say, what's the difference between what Somalian pirates do and what Israel does? There's no difference.
But it happened before and away from the cameras. That's why they want to jam all cameras. Any live feed, any video, all of that is confiscated to make sure that the world does not see Israel doing what it does.
It's going to be a lot harder to do that this time, because when we went the last time, which was almost a year ago, we had one small boat. And even then, we were able to get some of the footage out and upload it. But now you've got six boats and 700 people. Unless they want to do something like bomb us all at once, it's not going to happen. People are going to get feeds out, and people are going to be able to take pictures. And there's been enough coverage now on this flotilla that people are beginning to realize, and certainly in Europe, people are beginning to realize that this flotilla is on its way, and who's on board and what's on board. And it's going to be very, very difficult for Israel. To be honest with you, this is a public relations disaster for Israel, because no matter what they do, they're going to look awful.
That doesn't seem to concern them, Greta.
Oh, I think it does. I actually think it does. I think they're having a hysterical nervous breakdown over us. If you look at the, you know, we have Hebrew translators, because we have a lot of people who speak Hebrew who are Israeli Palestinians, and so they translate a lot of this. Now, maybe if it's in the English press, you might not know it, but in the Hebrew press, they're having a nervous breakdown. I'm hoping that we are giving them sleepless nights, and that they are spending an awful lot of our money, because it always is our money, trying to figure out how to stop us. I don't think that they know what to do, because everything that they've tried to do, such as having a press conference and saying that 50 trucks a day go into Gaza, and then having the United Nations agency come back and say, I'm sorry, but it used to be 250 trucks a day, and you're starving the people of Gaza. It's been a disaster for them.
Mm.
Thank goodness.
That's great. That's great. This time, I think you will have made your point.
I think this time we will not only have made our point, but this will not be the last point. This is not about taking a flotilla in just one time. This is about opening up a sea lane for the people of Gaza to do what every one of us has the right to do, and that's have access to your own sea. Gaza is the only territory in the world. The only territory. Just think about it. Gaza is the only territory in the world that has no access to its own sea. To its own sea, it doesn't have its access. The fishermen can't go out and fish past about a mile now. It has no access to its own sea, to its own fishing resources, to its own right to come in and to come out. And, of course, this is all under the guise that, oh, my God, this has got to be all about Israel's security. Well, what about the security for the people of Gaza? And what about the people, the security of the people of Palestine in general? Why is it always about Israel's security, and why are they allowed to do what they do? And that's what we're trying to stop.
Kevin Nisch is a social justice and peace activist based in Victoria, BC. He works with the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid in Victoria. He's a retired engineer and has participated in numerous solidarity campaigns in Canada, Latin America, and Palestine.
My name is Kevin Nisch, and according to the National Post, I'm a short-day socialist. So I guess you're a jihadist. Are you Farouk? Yeah, okay, fine, daddy. I'm up from Victoria, BC. I've been an activist all my life since the Vietnam War. For those who don't remember, that's in the 1960s. I was a human shield at Guatemala for Rigoberto Menchu. I was a human rights observer, election observer in El Salvador in 2009. I was a human shield in 2002 with the International Solidarity Movement in Bethlehem, exactly a year before Richard Carter was murdered. 2009, I was a human rights observer in Colombia. I was visiting political prisoners in Colombia, and in fact, the spring of this year, I was in Colombia visiting political prisoners there. The point of all this is, and I've done lots of work in North South Africa, Ireland, Philippines, Chile, all over the world. You name it, it's just a great time. Bragging, it's my mom's fault. She started me on this route. But the point is that the nut bar Zionists are saying that I'm anti-Semitic, that I only hate Israel. I can prove it. I'm not anti-Semitic. I'm anti-political Zionism. I'm an anti-racist. And that's why I'm against the anti-racist. Really covered a lot of what I needed to talk about. But I'll go to the flotilla. I was part of the Free Gaza flotilla. That's the original flotilla, original challengers of the blockade. Since 2008, Free Gaza has been sending single ships and large fishing boats to try and get in. I think they tried seven times. George Galloway got in on one of the ships early on. I think he got four ships in, and then the last three, one was a ram, and almost sunk. It eventually did sink, but luckily it got back to Cyprus, and two of them were boarded by the Israelis and towed into Ashdod. And the boats have never been seen again, nor was the aid. And so that's how Free Gaza was treated. So this is the I think it was the aid. But this time, many groups joined. It's building. It's going to get bigger. This time there was many movements. There was going to be eight ships. I was on one of the Free Gaza ships. It was an American flag ship, actually both of them, Challenger 1, Challenger 2, about a 70-foot, each of them older, two-deck yacht, not very big. And we see a little Crete, and the Israelis have flagged that they sabotaged our ship, sabotaged both of our ships, as well as the Rachel Corrie, which was sailing out of Iraq. All three ships were damaged. We lost our steering, and nobody's talked about this, but they came close to killing us because they bragged about sabotaging our ship. We lost our steering in the middle of somewhat of a storm between Crete and Cyprus. We were beaten up so bad, you can imagine trying to maneuver without proper steering. We were beaten up so bad we split seams in our hull and started to take on water. And we were going to Gaza. After the storm abated, we got to the right London point. And the captain said, "We're taking on water. We're not going to sink now, but we're not going to go to Gaza." And so we thought things were finished. But it's like the cavalry over the horizon came, the Mavi Lev Farouk and 680 other Turkish activists, and they asked the Mavi if they would take us on. Our ship had about 11 activists, no cargo other than small donations, but it was our ship had Colonel Ann Wright from the United States Army, the retired colonel that was barred from coming to Toronto. We had three German MPs, a Korean MP from Norway, I believe, and a German doctor. We had a fellow from a Palestinian whose mother was dying in Gaza, and he was desperate to get there, and he was joining the flotilla to get to Gaza and see his dying mother. His mother died the day before the attack. But we got to check my notes, keeping on track here. I'll be very quick. We lost our steering, take on water. So we transferred to the Mavi Marmo. And that's an interesting point in this thing. This huge ship pulled up to our little yacht. The side door opened up, and it was calm water, so we just jumped on board. And they immediately frisked, took my baggage off one side. And they frisked me, talked about them thoroughly, and quarantined me. And every person came on board got the same treatment. All the activists that came on board, we all got patted down, put into a quarantine on deck one, and waited while they went through our bags to find to go. Me being a mechanic, I had a pocket knife in my bag, and it wasn't there when I got my bag back. I guess it was pulled out and pushed over the side. The film crew with us from Australia, they had some booze in their bag. Booze was taken out over the side. They didn't want weapons on that ship. And no booze. You know, those Muslims. But they were thorough. They were thorough about no weapons on the ship. And after they searched us and quarantined us for a while on the first and deck one, which was where some of the aid was stored in big pallets, as well as the women. The women could go anywhere, but the first deck was for women alone if they wanted to be on the boat. I think it was 50 to 100 women on board. But the women were all through the ship. Many journalists, which I thought was wonderful, women journalists from Arab nations and Turkey. And anyways, I'm probably rambling. I'll get back on topic here. Quarantine, baggage, pocket knife. So my job was, the reason I was on the flotilla was to break the blockade. We gotta break the blockade. I don't care if they'll give us roses and dance in the streets to let us go to Ashdod to take it to Gaza. We're not going to Egypt or Israel, we're going to Gaza. I was the My job was being a human rights observer. When I got to Gaza, I was going to be working with the International Solidarity Movement, ISM, and basically doing exactly what Rachel Corrie was doing before she was murdered. I was going to be working on the wells and the sewer system in Rafah, patrolling the border between Egypt and Rafah to stand and be witnessed and be a human shield in between the Israelis and the Palestinian people. So on the ship, I had no chores to do then. On the Challenger 2, I was to slow down the Israelis to allow the film crew, Australian film crew, to upload to the satellite their film footage. So my job was to stand in a very narrow passageway and be a rugby player like my good old school days, to stand there and nonviolently stop these folks. But that job was finished. And I was I was free to do anything on the runway. On Andy Marmara, I could go anywhere, not anywhere. The top deck was secure, obviously the bridge and the communication center on the top deck. Otherwise, I could go anywhere, speak to anyone. I broke bread, had tea with many, many wonderful people, some of them dead now. So what did I see? I had a day to cruise around and observe and great bread, and basically I saw a bunch of some women. I saw the 89-year-old patriarch of the Church of Jerusalem. It took two men to help him move around the deck, and he was on the arrest list in Israel. They wanted him, this ancient, tottering old man, and he was on board, and there was an 11-month-old child of the chief engineer, and his wife was on board. Again, many women, a lot of retired old men like me, not like me, I guess, but you can see, if you go to cultures of resistance.com, I believe, Yara, that's I-A-R-A, she's a Brazilian filmmaker, she smuggled out 1 hour of video, and it's got me in it, 44-minute mark, you see me. She smuggled it somehow, she got it up, and it's wonderful. It shows a half hour before the attack, and then a half hour of the attack. So you'll get it's rough footage, so you'll get a real live idea of who was on that ship. And don't take my word for it, look at the video. Google Maddie Marmara, go to freegaza.org, anything will lead you back to that film, and you'll see who was on that ship. It was full of middle-aged older men, professionals, school teachers like me. I used to be a school teacher, and women. And, I mean, there were some young folks on there, but for the most part, it was older men and women. And this bullshit about ship of hate is bizarre. So what did I see? I was cruising around the deck just before the attack. Actually, the reason they thought I was dead was because everybody thought I was dead, was that the last time anybody saw me, I was standing in the moonlight speaking to Sarah, who was an American activist, on the port side at the forward deck, on the third deck. And that's the last time anybody saw me, because from that point I went down and had a nap. But because that was the last thought anybody saw me, they all told the embassy that, well, that's the last time you saw Kevin. Well, that's where the helicopter murdered the first two people, I understand. But they shot right there and massacred a couple of people. And when embassy found me, they walked in there and said, Kevin Nash, Kevin Nash, Kevin Nash. I said, what, it's me? He says, you're Kevin Nash. He said, yeah, Kevin Nash. You're supposed to be dead. I said, well, I'm not. Well, you were killed on the deck. You're thrown overboard. Never, everybody said. But luckily, I was, somebody else is in my spot, unfortunately. I went down and had a nap. But before I went down, I toured the upper deck, and what I saw was the aid workers laying out fire hoses. They had long 10-foot wooden boat hooks for pulling Zodiacs in, or boats, but they were going to use it to push the Israelis away. Like I said, they had charged up all the fire hoses, salt-watered fire hoses. I saw gas masks, I saw many floodlights, handheld floodlights. The whole ship was lit up with many floodlights pointing out, cameras pointing all over the place to watch for what was coming. And what I saw, which took my breath away, on the front T-can railing on the third deck across the front, were nuts and bolts. Somebody had gone to the engine room and collected up nuts and bolts to throw at these radios. I couldn't believe it. I was thunderstruck. What do they think they're doing? So I brought my camera up, and one of the Turkish aid workers from Ihaha waved at me as if I was taking a picture of a nuclear device. No, 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 he says, no pictures. I'm like, you're being polite. You're mad. The Israelis are going to come in with whatever, submarines and ships and helicopters, and you've got nuts and bolts to throw at them. And you're like, and there's like stations. There was a pile here, then about 10 feet, there'd be another pile along the handwriting. Anyways, after that, they were putting on their life jackets at that point. It was quite a scramble. Now, I wouldn't say panic, but people were getting prepared because they thought we were going down. Understand, everybody's putting life jackets on. They thought we were going down because we were going to Gaza or we were going down. That's the thinking on the ship. So I went down to have a nap, thinking that the Israelis want to attack. This ship's full of old men, some very, very old men, women, living with a little child, and we're in international waters, and it's dark. But they're not going to attack me. So I went down to have a nap, and I actually pooped some people when they were killed. I said, no, get your life jacket off and get it ready. They were right, I was wrong. So at 4 o'clock, Ezra was saying, you should have put the picture back up. You put the picture back up, bro? You don't mind. It gives you something to look at besides me. So that's a picture of the back. You don't mind. It's a good picture. Next one, is it? Oh, the one at the back. There we go. There, that's perfect. That's great right there. Sure. Yeah, so there's the Navi. So I was sitting right behind the Turkish flag. The flag wasn't there, but there's that's deck 2 lounge. You can see the open stern on deck 2. Deck 1 had no access. Deck 1 is down below, no access to the other side. That's where the women were, that's where the Israeli commandos that were captured were taken. So I was actually that window that you can see is almost where I was. And I was just getting up and getting my camera batteries ready and this and that, and getting prepared to I didn't think anything was going to happen, but all of a sudden, that lower deck erupted, and it was just behind a set of windows. There's windows along the back there. And the whole thing erupted in flames, flash grenades, percussion grenades. The windows were, and these are heavy windows, they were moving. And the whole thing was enveloped in tear gas. And I could hear bang, 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 and hearing things hit things. So I didn't know if it was live ammo. Or I guess it wasn't at that point. It wouldn't have rubber bullets, I guess. And probably he said he had paint guns. These weren't just regular paint guns, they were paintball guns. These were paintballs with like a tear gas solution or a pepper spray solution inside. And they said there was actually hard things inside the paintballs. I heard this from a number of people. But it was like chemical weapons being shot at these at the activists. It wasn't just paint. So anyways, that whole back lower deck erupted. But there was big floodlights around, and what it was two ships with about 30 foot rigid hull Zodiacs with about 20 soldiers each hold up either side, trying to throw grapples up and trying to get onto the deck. And I could see through the smoke these aid workers with gas masks and running with fire hoses back and forth and with long poles. Talking about courageous, and there were, you can actually see again if you check out the videos from Free Gaza, you'll see them. It's like a porcupine on the back pushing these Israelis away, pushing them away. Non-violently, just get away from our ship. It was repelling criminals. That's what we were doing, we were repelling criminals. So I decided that my place wasn't on the front line of this thing. They were professionals repelling. My job was to back up and take my camera and do my human rights observation work. So I retired to the inner stairwell, which is about even with just in front of the forward lifeboat, I'd say. That there's a door that goes in there, and it goes between all three decks. So there's a stairwell from the spot from the first deck, the house from the second, third, and then the fourth deck is the one that the lifeboats are sort of even with. And the top of the ship is where Fruit was saying that the helicopter hovered and dropped people on. Actually, it's above the bridge. It's upper deck, but it has access to the bridge. We weren't allowed up there. It was no access to that area other than stairways or lounge. So I retired to that. As I walked through the stairwell, I think it was deck, it would have been deck two, I took note that there was a medical station with a tarpaulin for enough for one person, laid down, and I didn't even realize, but I saw the two for sure, Israeli soldiers captured, commandos coming in. Who knows how they captured them, but there was initially three came down, and they somehow they overwhelmed these guys, and they were armed. Anybody said they weren't armed is fine, because it was activists took the guns off of them, emptied the bullets, and I heard it in the prison, I heard it afterwards, I heard it many places that they emptied the bullets over the side. Except for one gun that Ken O'Keefe took. He's the ex-Marine from Ireland, he's the one that got beaten up in the Israeli airport for not signing the voluntary deportation letter. You know, you gotta sign that voluntary deportation letter or you get beat up. But he got rid of the bullets, but he hid his gun that he took off, thinking that he could use it as evidence if the ship did get through to prove that the Israelis landed with weapons. And the Israelis are saying that they found that gun, and they're saying that gun was used against them. And it's, well, I believe Ken, and there's people there that watched it. He pulled it over the side. He simply kept the gun as evidence, hid it somewhere, and they found it. So I'm probably rambling on here. I'm going to thank your nuts and bolts. Yeah. So what they used was, I mean, there were no arms on that ship. I watched while after those two Israeli soldiers were dragged in, they were terrified. They were kids, and they were terrified. And I felt sorry for them because they were yammering and wrenching. Well, the one, you give me a 5-minute warning. One was being held by arms and legs, and he was thrashing and yammering and screaming. His eyes were as big as saucers. And they were busy taking the knife off his leg. The guns were already gone. They took the guns off on the deck. But they were taking the knife off his leg, they were taking his ammo belts off, his backpack, and this and that. And a great big Turk, because they'd already killed at least two people on the deck by then, because they shot before they landed. The captain says that, and so does El Jazeera. I didn't see it, but I trust these people. A great big Turk who was just enraged, this large man, he climbed over top of the aid workers who were holding the Israeli, and he tried to lay a haymaker on this guy, and he wanted to kill him. Obviously, he was just enraged. The two aid workers dropped the Israeli's feet, turned, pushed him down the stairs, pinned this guy against the wall, and were screaming at him in Turkish. And, I guess they were screaming at him, "You don't do that. You don't touch this man. You know, back off." And very quickly, somebody else grabbed both legs. Well, they pinned this guy, and they rushed that Israeli soldier down the stairs. They were protecting these guys, and I saw it. So they rushed him down. All right. They rushed him down the stairs, I followed. They took him downstairs, and then there were bodies by then coming in from other decks already down below, but they took care of these guys. You'll see the pictures, you've seen the pictures, I'm sure. I've got pictures of it, and other pictures have turned up. That there's a big Turkish doctor there, and he's cleaning up the wound on these fellows and clean them up. Then they took them down to the first deck. I couldn't follow then, but they took them down to the first deck, the women's deck. That was the safest place to keep them because there was no access to the outside, and they just held them there for their own safety. Two came in. One carried. The second one was standing, and they hurried him down the stairs, rushed. He had a blood on his face I guess they gave him a face plant at the deck, but he was fine. Well, he certainly looked alive and well, he wasn't unconscious. And then there was one more that I took a picture of, not realizing it was an Israeli, but there was three of them that were captured that I ended up seeing. And like I say, from what I saw, they protected them. and took them down below for their own safety. The weapons, being told of that, it was hardware off the ship. It was, again, nuts and bolts, it was sticks, it was broom handles, it was stanchions, which I'm a marine engineer, but it's like fence posts, steel fence posts that are removable for getting to the lifeboats. And they had chains that they had, I could hear them grinding when I was actually going to bed. I went, what maintenance are they doing it now, on a ship? What they were doing, they were grinding off the little chains that were used to section off the lifeboats. And they were grinding them off the one end. So these were about 3-foot chains. I wouldn't lock my bike up in a small town, let alone Toronto. These were just little short chains, and they were using that to whip at the Israeli soldiers. And that's why 9 got killed and about 40 wounded, because they had sticks and bars and 3-foot chains against a man with a machine gun the length of this stage away from them. And that's and a helicopter above shooting down. So that's why it was a massacre. That's why, I witnessed it. I didn't see anything that was brought on board that was a weapon, other than you'll see it in the film. Two fellows brought on little child-size slingshots. And you'll see it in Yara Lee's film that these fellows are on the fourth deck shooting up at the helicopter, shooting marbles up at the helicopter. And they're risking their lives. They're jumping out in the open, shooting at the helicopter, jumping back. Marbles, for God's sakes. But anyways, that's... shouldn't laugh. So what happened then? The commandos... After the commanders came down the stairs, I went back up. That's when the dead and wounded poured in. I've repeated this a million times. Dying story novels talk about there was blood flowing down the stairs. There was blood flowing down the goddamn stairs. There was pools of blood dripping from stair to stair to stair. It was just, I must have saw 2 dozen bodies, well, people dragged in alive and dead. How much time?
Two
minutes. Make sure I got the... we can ask you about the hit list later on. Maybe you've heard about it. I saw 2 people on... and like, I eventually went downstairs to look at the bodies or the people downstairs. I saw one fellow laying there, body with a pair of bullet holes the side of his head. I thought, that looks like execution to me. I thought, but I'm, that's going way out there, that's horrendous, that's, I don't even want to think that. Even the Israeli soldiers, I saw a second body, blew a whole side of the head. And again, these people are wounded other places. And I kept that to myself. I thought they were executing people on the deck. They got hit, they rolled up in a ball, somebody walked up and they call it double clicking in Iraq, the Americans, click, click. But I kept quiet about that until I landed in Victoria, and I heard from the Turkish authorities that at least four of their 9 dead were shot at close range with shots to the head. So I saw 2. So I could start and end my whole presentation by saying these people executed 4 aid workers who were wounded and helpless on the deck. And I've seen the proof, and the Turks produce the proof, and I could walk away now and you can just go home with that, and that's all. There's nothing else to say. Ignore the $4,000 they stole from me, ignore the wounds, ignore the bathroom that I didn't get to see for 15 hours, the beatings, the guns to my head. What more can you say? But I'll carry on. The whole thing wrapped up with, I was on the fourth deck, the wooden door opened up to the outside, a machine gun stuck in, and an Israeli soldier started shooting into this metal bulkheaded stairwell. He didn't care who he hit. Bullets were ricocheting everywhere, and he just let go. And 2 aid workers, one with a chain and one with a bar, beat that fellow back. Whipping, I couldn't see his hand, all I saw was a barrel of a slip, but he was whipping and beating the fellow back, and then the big Turk reached around and grabbed the broken porthole and slammed the door shut. Then he took position to the side of the door, and I got a picture of it. If you check out the Free Gaza, it's a picture of one guy on each side with a bar to defend themselves against the Israeli machine gun, and wrap me up. So what happened then, if that soldier had gone in, he would have killed all of us. He wanted to kill anybody in there. So what happened, luckily what happened was the Israelis took control of the bridge. So what happened then, if this is important, the captain came on the PA system, and he announced in Turkish or Arabic, I guess, that the bridge had been seized by the Israelis, that they're not going to Gaza, that stop resisting. And this is important because everybody, all the Israelis are saying that I was a dupe, and I was simply used to bring the Israelis and Jews onto the ship so that these terrorists, Farouk, could kill Jews. And you've heard this over and over again. If that was the case, they would have killed those three commandos immediately, and they wouldn't have stopped fighting. Because what happened when the captain announced that the bridge had been taken, it was like a magnetic switch had been thrown. Everybody around me dropped their hardware. They dropped the chains, they dropped the bars, they dropped the sticks. It was automatic, they just dropped it. If that was the case, they would have killed those three commandos immediately, and they wouldn't have stopped fighting. Because what happened when the captain announced that the bridge had been taken, it was like a magnetic switch had been thrown. Everybody around me dropped their hardware. They dropped the chains, they dropped the bars, they dropped the sticks. It was automatic, they just dropped it. I didn't even have to hear the English translation because I knew what had happened. I thought, oh, the bridge has been taken. We're not going to Gaza, because they just dropped it. They turned, and they obediently, like a bunch of sheep, walked down the stairs and went to the assembly areas and lounges and just waited for the Israelis to cuff us and brutalize us some more. So that's it. It's what I saw, that they weren't there. They were there to get aid to Gaza. And when the captain said, we're not going to Gaza, there was no sense hurting anybody anymore. If they wanted to hurt people, they would have carried on fighting and drawn the Israeli soldiers inside, where a 3-foot bar would have hurt the Israelis. Doorway to doorway, room to room, hatch to hatch, they would have fought. But they didn't. They didn't. The second they gave, couldn't get to Gaza, they dropped the weapons, they dropped their hardware, and stopped the resistance. And And if you want to know more, go to freegaza.org, because there's a Canadian ship going in September. We're going to raise $300,000. The Turks already made me promise if I'm going back whether I want to or not. So I know Turks going back tonight. If they want me, if they want a tired old worn out guy again, I'll go again. So that's our hundred questions.
Our next speaker is going to be Jesse Rosenfeld. Jesse is a Canadian print and video journalist based in Ramallah and Tel Aviv, Jaffa since 2007. He's the print editor of the Daily Nuisance. He's also written from the Middle East for so many publications, and you'll recognize most of them, I think. The Guardian, The Nation, The National, which is an Abu Dhabi English newspaper, Haaretz English, The Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, Now Magazine, Zenit, and Electronic Intifada. He's also been a blogger with allvoices.com and Mondovice. Produced video content for The Daily Beast and The Real News.
The theme of the evening is looking at siege and the effect of siege. And something to understand about sieges is that they only continue as long as they've got the consent of everyone to isolate that place. And the same is true with apartheid. And with that, I'm going to start by talking about the Flotilla Massacre. The Israeli military, as we saw, massacred 9 people when they landed their troops in the most densely populated civilian ship earlier this month, that when they landed commandos on the deck, allegedly firing live ammunition from the helicopters, according to the ship's captain, when they locked those that they had shot in the basement, refusing medical attention, only negotiating for over an hour before in exchange for soldiers that had been captured and medical attention for everyone on the ship was agreed upon. The soldiers actually had been treated for their injuries by ship's medics, though. There were assassination lists that Al Jazeera had exposed, booklets of names of activists, some of which, and some of those killed had similar facial features and similar identities to those in the booklets. So what we saw was this massacre played out in front of Al Jazeera and the international media. And it's kind of baffling as to why, really. They had maintained a siege on Gaza for 3 years and successfully contained 1.5 million people while keeping the world at bay from breaking what is arguably one of the most severe manufactured humanitarian crises and war crimes that we see in the world today. And what we saw happen was the Israeli army somehow believed that they could treat the international activists the same way they treat Palestinians daily, and that the world would turn a blind eye to that as well. Now, the reality of that was that it's calculated. What we saw was a spin out where they weren't able to control the media message. What we've seen is them diplomatically doing backwards cartwheels and now having to alleviate the siege and put a new spin on their flow of humanitarian aid as with the motto of the siege being over. Realistically, they're allowing a bit more aid in. So we saw them lose there drastically. But it's understandable when you look at what happened on the ship, why they thought they could get away with it. And it's because they, and you can see this in the rhetoric that the Israelis have put out since then. Consistently, they've maintained the same PR stance of a state under siege that they've always maintained. It's just it doesn't seem to be washing particularly well anymore. So, you know, while a lot of people have speculated that this was a bad mix of planning that led to unfortunate incidents, what we can understand from the Israeli strategy that this was completely intentional and just politically not working for them. And I'll explain why. Basically, what we saw on the flotilla was the army landing in the most densely populated and where they knew there was going to be a clash with armed commandos in international waters. Now, why did they do that? Well, what they had clearly intended to do there was send a message to the activists, a bloody message, that you, we understand you may not recognize the legitimacy of this 3-year siege that we've imposed, but you're going to understand our force, and you're going to understand directly what it is that we are willing to do to keep Gaza out of sight of the rest of the world. And the reason they made that decision was because basically this was becoming the major channel for recognition of Palestinians, an interaction that was not controlled by the Israelis. It was the one way you could go to Gaza and not have to be facilitated through Israeli government officials, through an Israeli PR apparatus, through an Israeli technocratic and bureaucratic control process where they get to understand and try and fully control the situation. And what they really didn't like about that was that you had former congresspeople on the boats. You had European members of parliament. So it wasn't a message to the activists who actually fought and died, because they were willing to do that. It was a message to the liberal establishments in the West that have started to basically be unable to ignore the situation in Gaza any longer. So send a message to them. We know you don't really care about Arabs and don't think this is going to be worth it. So this is you may hate us for it, but after this, you're not going to get on another boat. And they wanted to send that message to that community. And then at the same time, they wanted to try and be able to control the international reaction. And basically understand that they were going to take some criticism. And they were going to take some heat. But then they were going to return to normalcy. The normalized relations of U.S. backing, the normalized relations of mild criticism with Europe while a 60% trade relation maintains itself. They were going to go back to, sure, things were tense with Turkey, but it actually kind of played up both parties' interests. The Turks had an interest in terms of hostility towards Israel as becoming a Western broker for the U.S. and the Middle East. The Israelis had an interest in terms of national protectionism and the rallying of jingoism that's been going on in that society around any force that has become more critical as Israeli actions have become more obnoxious. And so they wanted to send a message to them that this was within the terms of self-defense, that this was in the terms of international legitimacy, and this was in the terms of protecting Israeli citizens. So what they immediately did was they put out a call, they went into immediate reaction over the killings and justifying them. And they tried to justify them within the international terms of engagement, within their own military codes of engagement. And so what they were immediately doing was putting out a defense for their actions. And what they said was, we were under attack. They were attacking us with stones and poles. We only used live ammunition after soldiers of ours had been taken. We were in a crisis situation. And they provided contradictory examples throughout the entire process in defining what was happening with action. We saw time and time again claims of photos that they were making in terms of being attacked, actually being doctored from different eras in different events. We saw time and time again their claims of live fire not matching the reality of the situation, as most of those killed were shot in the neck, in the back of the head, in the back. It just wasn't adding up, but they were still pushing that line, because what they were trying to send a message to the world was we know this is messy, we know this is complicated, you may disagree with it, we're within our terms of defense, and we're going to try and ride it out. And the reason I thought I could get away with this, and it may seem completely absurd to everyone outside the country, and I'm just sitting in my apartment all the time thinking and saying regularly, how absurd it is that they're getting away with stuff like this, but how absurd it is that the way Israelis are conceiving it and hearing the news, and at the same time completely buying into a glossed over vision of events in the Middle East that effectively don't have Palestinians outside of a military capacity, and we're talking about the majority population where they live. And that kind of sealed off bubble gives some insight into why they thought they could get away with this. It's because it's the way they treat Palestinians all the time. And a good example of that, in a very similar situation with Flotilla, was when I was covering the story of four boys that were killed in Nablus in March. It started in the village of Arak Barim when the Israeli soldiers decided to seize a road to basically secure it as a throughway for settlers to get to a religious site. And it was a town that had recently launched a popular struggle, and these are local committees of different political factions and social institutions that do popular mobilized demonstrations to exercise the land as a sign of defense for it. When the army comes, they clash in order to defend it. So what happened was the army came into town to seal it off. People came out and started clashing with the army to prevent the settlers from being able to use that road as a throughway. Now, what happened at that point was the Israelis opened up with live ammunition, according to, for example, the International Solidarity Movement's media coordinator who was there at the time. And they had seized the center of town, and they started firing live ammunition kind of indiscriminately, and two kids were killed, 17 and 18, I believe. And the justification immediately was, we were under attack, there were rocks being thrown, and what was interesting was that they denied the use of live ammunition. They denied it to this day, despite what all the x-rays have shown. They've still claimed it's rubber and it's plastic rubber bullets and tear gas and plastic tipped bullets. So that they've continued to maintain that claim to this day, despite what the Palestinian hospitals have shown. But their, again, immediate defense was, we were under attack, and we had, they had means, which were stones, to kill us, and they had intent, they didn't want us there. Now, what was interesting was that they were at a T-junction intersection, they could have left the town anytime they wanted to. They didn't have to secure a Palestinian road that connects Palestinian villages for settlers, but instead they decided to stay, entrench themselves, and send the message by creating two dead boys. Now, the same thing repeated itself the next day. I went out to the funeral in Arak Barim. I wasn't there when the kids were killed. And it was a huge community outpouring. It was first casualties in that area in a long time. And the reason, I'll get to that actually later. There's this huge outpouring, and the media is absolutely everywhere. And it's interesting because, no sooner had the bodies been put in the grave, and I was actually talking to kids who had gone to high school with the kids when someone walked over to me and told me that just across the way, just on the other side of Nablus, in this village of Huarte, two other kids had just been killed. And we were shocked. We thought, immediately, rumors. And why would the Israelis stage such a provocation? And it was interesting. So I jumped in with the Daily News photographer, jumped in a car with an AP photographer. We buzzed, we sort of jetted out of Iraq Marine towards the Huarte. The army had shut off access to the town. And so we weren't getting in. And so we decided to double back to the Nablus Hospital and see what had happened with the bodies. Well, it was interesting because it took us about 30 minutes to drive, because you're driving through Nablus and you're going through a checkpoint. And then about another 20 minutes to drive back to the hospital, which is in the center of Nablus, and the bodies still haven't arrived. And immediately, it's obvious that something is, that not only is something up, but the Israelis are covering up. And so, eventually, an hour after we're at the hospital, the bodies arrive. And they're both shot from close range. Following the ambulances is a sobbing father, who looked like, at least for the past several blocks, had just walked the entire way. They were related, I believe they were cousins. And he immediately says the Israelis have assassinated these boys. And we wonder what's going on, and immediately the story starts to trickle in. Basically, they were farming in their fields, and they were near a nearby settlement. The army had been called, they showed up, the boys were asked to present IDs, they were marched off by the army. 5 minutes later, shots were heard. The army claims, and continued to claim, when I immediately got on the phone with them when I heard this, they immediately began to claim that the boys had attacked the army. That they had attacked the soldiers with, first, and I went through, I think, 7 different phone calls. First, they said they attacked them with garden picks. Then they said they attacked them with axes and axe handles. Then it was shovels, I believe it was. Then it was rocks. Finally, the story that they settled on was that they were taken in for a polite questioning, which means they weren't handcuffed, which means that they were brought to the side of the road while their IDs were checked, and the soldiers didn't see it as threatening enough to detain them in any more confined fashion. And then, apparently, according to the army, they went crazy, and one picked up a syringe, and one picked up a bottle of rocks, and tried to attack the soldiers. Now, I've never seen a bottle of rocks, and there isn't a hell of a lot of heroin in the West Bank, so I haven't seen many syringes either. And that was the army's position, and the reason was, like with the Flotilla Massacre, they thought they could get away with it. They thought they could ride it out. Why were they doing this now? Well, what had happened was Israel, when this happened, was under severe pressure from what was happening with the protests in Sheikh Jarrah and so on, the expansions in Jerusalem. It started to even receive criticism for its repression against wall demonstrations in the West Bank from the Western community. The siege was really gaining momentum in terms of bringing attention. And so what the Israelis wanted to do, and this is why they targeted Nablus. Nablus was the heart of armed resistance in the Second Intifada. The Israelis were unable to break it. They sieged it. They sieged it bitterly. But they were never able to fully force out the fighters of the old city, The Knights of Nablus, which were part of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, held on to their guns. Hamas, during the Intifada, had a stronghold, and the Israelis were not able to fully occupy that city. They were able to siege it with snipers around. And the only people that broke that armed resistance and that broke the struggle of Nablus were actually the PA, who co-opted and negotiated the guns away, and since January this year, the army has been running free-reign assassination squads in the city. So why did they do this in Nablus then? I mean, it's a city of historic resistance. You think there'd be reprisal? Maybe that's exactly what they were going for. Maybe it was at that point their desire, and this is clear in terms of the way that they provoked, they wanted to spark violence, a violent response from Palestinians that could set in motion a rapidly expanding resistance that would fall out on their terms, because they had already cut up the West Bank with the wall, and they had already sealed it off from Gaza, and they knew there was a revolt about to happen at some point, so they wanted to do it on their own terms and be able to control the way the violence and the way the struggle played out, so that they could basically control their PR message and control a blunt military response. And it failed. And it failed in Nablus because you have struggle across the West Bank right now that has learned the experience of the Second Intifada, which put their best activists dead or in jail, and has left an even more entrenched, broken Palestinian Authority that is entirely reliant on a collaborator relationship with Israel. They understood that they could use that and that network to quell any real substantial security threat of violence, but the propaganda would be great. And so that's what we saw happen there. And they didn't get it because you have martyrs that have already, or those killed in demonstrations that have already been, the struggles across the West Bank against the wall have already developed an expectation of and a response to. And it's a revolt that is in full swing, and they called an intifada immediately. But let's talk a little bit about that struggle and what it's coming out of. As I said, you've never seen a larger cantonization in Palestine, in Palestinian society, than you currently see today. You see a complete segmentation of the West Bank, where you have in a fraction of the territory, a Palestinian Authority that is completely responsible to Israel, runs security operations and tackling Palestinian anti-occupation resistance, has recently started to go after people active in the boycott movement even, after they've been unable to co-opt that message. You have a Palestinian Authority that is willing to basically run the Israeli fractures through the most densely parts of the West Bank. You have a segmentation of Palestinian villages in the border areas from the heart of Palestinian society and culture within the West Bank. And I haven't even gotten to the separation of Gaza and the refugees and Palestinian citizens of Israel yet. And then you have a complete disconnect from Jerusalem. People who, for the most part, haven't gone since the Intifada, or haven't gone legally anyway, since the Second Intifada. And then you have Gaza, where through this Palestinian elite and through a sort of pumping of development dependency out of the Oslo Accords, you have a wealthy sort of Ramallah class that looks at the, down its nose to Gaza. I mean, it looks at them as a sort of, seaside overbaked, wasteland that they can control. I didn't really want to say it, but like they do very much look at Gaza as this sort of fractured, flattened place that they can sort of play politics with to maintain their own political power. And so you have that amongst a very real political national division that they've manufactured very much at the behest of the United States and at the pressure of Israel to hold on to their own political power, because let's look at the fact of where the guns are coming from, where the dollars are coming from, Western NGOs, Kalashnikovs from Jordan funneled through Israel. And so they've done their job within the West Bank of trying to segment and drive deep, unhealable splits. Because this is what Israel's strategy has always been. Israel has always designed, the separation between the West Bank and Gaza could not have been a bigger dream for Israel. It's been something they've been trying to achieve throughout the Oslo process. Something that had been resisted, but as the institutional mechanisms of the PA deepened their control, and as a leadership lost its popular legitimacy and was reliant far more on its crude power, as that sunk in, so did the full level of the kind of division that will take a new generation of Palestinians to get beyond in terms of national healing towards a liberation project. And by a new generation, I mean, kids under 30. So that's the segmentation there. Now you have a situation of Palestinian Israelis these days whose loyalty is constantly under question. And so every interaction they have with Palestinians or the greater Arab world is automatically an act of espionage, an act of subversion. And so you have this huge intimidation campaign politically to dissuade them from any sort of Palestinian national identification, Palestinian activism. You have a huge politically repressive state security apparatus has been systematically targeting Palestinian-Israeli political leadership. And that ranges from the fact that you've seen arrests of the main human rights groups leaders like Itish's leader, Amir, I forget his last name, that's really bad. You saw the targeting of the Stop the Wall campaign of Jamal Juma, the leader of the organization, while they then arrested the youth coordinator. That's the basic network for the grassroots campaign fighting the wall along the border lines. You've had a reintroduction of ideas around loyalty. You've had a severely violent police response to Palestinian activism. And then most recently with the flotilla, you have calls for indictments of espionage and terror, and I think terrorism was one of them, against Knesset members who are Palestinian that went on the flotilla to interact with Palestinians in Gaza, which is especially ironic because I'm living in Jaffa, and 90% of Gaza's population, 90% of Jaffa in 1948 was sent down the river on boats, pushed into the sea, if you will, and sent down to Gaza. And there's the natural family connection of Palestinians in Israel directly visiting relatives within Gaza. But that's a conception that Israel is not going to allow its Palestinian Israelis to hold, because if they conceive of people related within a national identity connected to Gaza, then they conceive of people within the West Bank, all of a sudden you have the shrugging off of the shackling of Israeli cantonization, new definitions of nation.
When Palestinian resistance has been strongest, it's when it's incorporated the majority of its population. And so what's highly interesting about that is that with the boycott movement, you're providing a direct dialogue between solidarity activists and the biggest portion of Palestinians. But what's interesting on the ground about it is that the boycott movement is becoming the framework and the form for joint struggle and for a future in the Middle East that both the radical Israelis and Palestinians unabashedly acknowledge as a Middle East without Zionism. It's a Middle East based on equal rights of all people, and it's based on free interaction. And it had to do everything with Canada's cutting of funding to UNRWA. And it speaks to the way that Canada develops its aid policy as its weapon of imperialism. And what happened was, after the Gaza War, a year after the siege is raging, Canada decides it's going to cut its funding to UNRWA in Gaza, one of the few major institutions, an institution that the Israelis bombed. One of the few major institutions that's distributing aid that has some sort of infrastructure for doing education, and part of that education program is, what do you know, consciousness development and Palestinian discussion of identity, which is obviously something that Canada is wanting to help Israel erase. So it cut its funding, but where did it put that money? And this is what's interesting. It put it into PA security. And the PA Security has been running a torture campaign, a well-exposed torture campaign, even in Vanity Fair as of 2 years ago, against any form of political opposition. As I pointed out, they've started to recently go after the boycott movement for incarceration, primarily Hamas activists that are in jail and some Islamic Jihad, but Palestinian leftists are getting rounded up. Anyone who's sort of posing a systematic threat to a maintained system of collaboration in apartheid, and a substantive threat to occupation that isn't within the PA's club, and class club at that, they're incarcerating and torturing, often with the same methods that the Israelis use in their jails. Two possible things: the Israelis could potentially be training them, haven't seen evidence on that. Could also be the fact that these were people that fought in the First Intifada, went to Israeli jails, were tortured in Israeli prison, and they're now carrying out the torture of their jailers. And Canada is directly involved in this. And I talked to Al Haq, which is a Palestinian legal human rights organization in the West Bank. It's part of the International Association of Jurists. And they were saying the main reason that torture is continuing, they've documented it, they've told the PA, they've told the Americans, it's all under the Dayton Plan, they've told the international community. Every party is aware that the Palestinian Authority's security forces are primarily a political institution that uses torture as its main political apparatus to dissuade a Palestinian population from reforming its national struggle. That they're actively using their aid to build that security apparatus and ingrain its message and its lessons onto Palestinian consciousness. And that's what Canadian aid does in Palestine.
So the first speaker is going to be Farouk Birni. He's the director of Al-Fakhura, an international campaign to defend the education rights of Palestinian students living in Gaza and the West Bank. He was transporting 65 computers to students in Gaza as part of the humanitarian mission that was attacked. He's been involved in nonprofit and activist work for the last 10 years in both North America and the Middle East.
So I have boarded the ship, the Mavi Marmara, in Antalya. Most of the other people had boarded the ship in Istanbul a few days earlier, and then the ship was actually docked in Antalya, and the reason for that was that we were waiting for other ships to come and join, ships coming from Greece, ships coming from other places to join us in international waters, and that was going to be sort of a rendezvous point where we would all meet in international waters. So we waited in Antalya for about 2 days for all these ships to be coordinated, and 2 days later, we set sail for Gaza. We arrived in international waters, which was about maybe a day past Cyprus, and that's where we docked, and we were waiting for other ships to join us. That process also took very long because countries such as Cyprus and other places were not allowing these ships to pass through. But we stayed there for about 2 days in the water, and that's where Kevin's ship, which was Challenger 2, also broke down, and this is where we took on additional passengers on the ship. Finally, 2 days later, we set sail for Gaza with a complete flotilla, which comprised of six ships in all. Three of these ships were cargo ships, the other three were passenger ships, and the Mavi Marmara being the largest. The plan was that what the situation currently is, that what they've declared is that 8 kilometers within waters, that is where the blockade starts for Gaza. As we set sail, we got information from the Israeli forces that they've actually extended that to 60 kilometers. So they would be intercepting us at 60 kilometers, which again was very surprising. So the plan was that we wanted to be in that area during daytime. In order for any activity to take place, we could see, we could negotiate, we could talk, or whatever was in store. But one message that was constantly relayed was that the Israeli army had said that we will not attack. We will not attack the ships, but we will stop them, whatever that meant. At that point, we didn't understand what that meant. Finally, on May 31st at 12:30 a.m., we received, this is when we're about close to 100 kilometers away from Gaza, we received a message from, or that our captain received a message from the Israeli army or Israeli navy asking us to identify ourselves and identify our location. The captain responded by saying that we are heading to Gaza. This is a humanitarian ship. We have humanitarian cargo, and this has people from the humanitarian community. They responded by saying that you are heading into forbidden waters, so please turn back or change your course. The response was from the captain is, please identify to us coordinates. What do you exactly mean by forbidden waters? Because according to our information, we're in international waters. No information was provided. Thereafter, at about 1 o'clock, the passengers were informed that the captain has spotted about 12 Navy ships that were closing in on the flotilla. And this is when we were told to put down or to wear our life jackets, because anything is possible at this time. So at this point in time, there was somewhat of a panic on the ship. We did not know what was going to happen. At a distance, we saw some lights that were not the lights of our ships, but these were perhaps the Israeli ships. Shortly after, the captain announced that still what we've done is actually we've changed course slightly, so in order for us to remain in international waters, so we're not heading towards the 60-kilometer zone that they had established. We were asked to go down to the main area, try to get some rest, because we're not anticipating any engagement for at least the next 3-4 hours. I guess that was determined by the distance of the ships. At about 3:30 in the morning, I was woken by one of my colleagues who was with me, and he said that the captain is telling all the passengers to put on their life jackets. These 12 ships, they are closing in very fast. 4 a.m. is prayer time, which is it was Fajr time, and the call for prayer was called at about 4:10. The prayer was held. At this point in time, many of the passengers were actually stationed around the boundary of Mavi Marmara, and they had they were basically on a lookout for any possible attacks. So they had set up floodlights in order for us to see. We could see ships in a distance, but anything that was going to come closer, they were keeping eye on that. At about 4:15, as people were finishing praying, people started yelling. They said, there they are, we see them. I personally looked overboard and I saw two army ships. They were small kind of assault ships, green in color. Each one of them was carrying about 20 commandos, all dressed in black with machine guns, face covered, and they were approaching very fast towards our ship. As they came closer, people on our ship, they had water hoses. They basically started spraying them with water. Simultaneously, a helicopter came in, and at this point, we started hearing gunshots. What they were gunshots. They were some people say that was live ammunition. Some say these were rubber bullets. But as the ships closed in, we could hear the things being fired onto the ship. As they came close, they threw in a smoke and a sound grenade, which was a huge explosion on the ship. And this is when women and some other people started yelling and screaming out of fear. At this point in time, the helicopter also came down and they tried to lure people onto the main bridge. Now, the organizers had basically gathered around the bridge because they knew that they were going to try to take over the bridge and try to either stop the ship or to change its direction. So this is where sort of this hand-to-hand combat broke out, as you see in the in some of the footage. And right after the lord, about 5-6 people, I guess they saw that, you know, the situation was very intense, and the helicopter left. 3 or 4 minutes later, a second helicopter came and they tried to lure more people towards the stern of the ship, and there were a lot of people there as well, so that kind of also failed. Third time when the mission came, the helicopter mission, this is when they physically started shooting at the people. And when I was there, I personally saw one man getting hit with a bullet on the chest. You know, he fell in front of us, myself, and there was another doctor. We were together, an Indonesian doctor. We approached him, we opened up his life jacket, opened up his shirt, and you could clearly see a gunshot wound to his chest and there was blood coming out. And at this point in time, it was very chaotic. There was bullets flying all over, there was sound, there was gunshot sound. We didn't know what was happening, where these shots were coming from, whether they were being fired from the small Zodiacs, where they were being fired from the helicopter. At one point, we had to leave this man lying there because we just couldn't, you know, stand up. We left, and then shortly after we came back, we tried to lift up this man. He was a big person, you know, he was very heavy, so a few of us pulled him inside, and, you know, we clearly see that he's dying, and shortly after he died. About 45 minutes into this, we heard the announcement by the organizers saying that the ship has been taken by Israelis. Please, we're requesting everyone to go down to the main sitting area and stay calm. The ship has been taken. So all of us, we went down to this area. We basically closed all the doors and barricaded ourselves. Outside, we could see that the commandos had come in with guns and their faces were covered. They were all around the ship. They were on board at this time. And through the window, they were pointing their guns. You could see their laser beams, you know, going all over. In my case, I was sitting my back to the window, and even if I looked back, they would point the gun to me, tell me to look back. So I was afraid that, you know, they were probably going to shoot me in the head or something. We kept sitting there, and the organizers announced to them saying that, you know, we don't have any weapons, we are not fighting you, please, we have injured people here, we need medical help. And where I was at this point, we had two dead bodies there, and there were other people who were bleeding. And so for about 1 hour, we pleaded to the Israeli army, asking them to please provide medical assistance. One of the women also came up with a poster, handwritten, saying, SOS, we need your help. We have people dying here. We need medical help. And they kept on just telling her to go away and go away. Finally, after 1 hour, they opened up the door, and they were pointing their guns, and they said that we want you to bring out your injured one person at a time. And they actually selected two women to bring out the injured people. So gradually, we started bringing out the injured people. Simultaneously, they told each one of us to come out with our hands on our head. So we did that. As soon as we went out there, they frisked us, they checked us, they took out all the belongings that we had, and they basically tied our hands behind our back and told us to go to the main deck. So one person at a time, we went up to the main deck. We were made to kneel down on our knees facing the wall. When I arrived there, this was about daytime, and I saw around me at least 6 Army and Navy ships, along with at least a dozen small Zodiacs that were basically patrolling our ship. And at this point, the ship was moving. So we were led to the main deck. We were made to kneel down for at least 6 hours. We stayed in that position. People were not allowed to go to the bathroom. People were basically passing out. You know, they were falling on their sides. Some of their people, their hands were tied extremely tight. And it was a very, very difficult situation. At about 1:30 in the afternoon, so this happened at close to between 7:30 and 8 o'clock, close to about 1:30, they told us all to get up and go down to the main floor, to the main sitting area where we had already been sitting. We went down and saw that they had basically ransacked the whole place. They had taken down the curtains, they had pulled the seats apart, our luggage was all over the place. They were checking for explosives or whatever they were looking for, and they told us to sit down. Still our hands tied. Now, I just like to mention here that while we were up on the deck, helicopters were continuously over us. They were transporting more soldiers. They were taking some of the injured and the dead bodies. Most of the people who were transported were the ones with gunshot wounds. So they were taken away. At about 1:30, as I said, we came down. They told us to sit down, and we just sat there with our hands tied. At about 6 o'clock, we reached Ashdod, which is a port city. we could see land at about 6 o'clock, 5:30, 6 o'clock. As we got to the port, they made an announcement. Some of the people came into the ship. I guess these were people from the immigration. They said that they're from the Ministry of Interior. They said the Army has done its job. Now you'll be handed over to the Ministry of Interior as you go on board. And these people were, I guess, some very professional, perfect English, very polite. They said to us that, you know, from here you'll be taken outside within 20 minutes. You will be provided with medical care, you'll be provided with food, and right after that you'll be deported to your relevant countries, either by land or by air. Now, at this point in time, we had thought that there was about 3 people killed, because that's what we saw. As you might know, that we had one of the members of the Knesset with us, Hanin Zoubi. She was basically, they couldn't arrest her, so she was a liaison between us and the soldiers. At this point, she came to us and told her that about 19 people had been killed. And that was a huge shock for us, because we couldn't, you know, we had seen 3 dead people. And she said 19 have been killed and close to 100 have been injured. So that was a big shock for us. We stayed sitting in that position inside once the ship was docked for another 4 to 5 hours. In my case, about 4 hours. Kevin was there for about 12 hours. Finally, they processed us out. Once again, they tied us extremely tight in my case. You know, they looked at my passport, they said, well, you're Canadian, have you told them that you're Canadian? I said, never asked me. And at this point, they had tied my hands extremely tight, and I told the guard, I said, could you please loosen this, because my hands are turning purple, there's no blood circulation. He looked at me and he said, no, and he said, enjoy yourself, and he just sort of kicked me out. And so as we got out, there was a huge crowd there, people were cheering, people were happy, there was media, there was press. And so for each person, we had one young soldier from the Israeli Navy and one policeman who basically took us into the processing area. Once we got there, once again, they looked at my passport. They saw that I worked in Qatar. I was born in Pakistan, so that was kind of confusing for them. So they said to me, what were you doing going to Gaza? And I said, well, we're on a humanitarian mission. And his response was, do you believe in the state of Israel? And I just kind of looked at him, and he said, well, we're a humanitarian country, can't you see that? So I just sort of stayed quiet. I said, yes, I guess so. And so thereafter, I was taken into another area. It was strip searched. They looked at everything that I had, opened up my wallet, searched me, and they said, you're going to be deported. So here's a piece of paper, sign this. I said, what if I don't sign this? They said, well, then you'll be put in prison. So you sign this, and you're going to the airport. I said, all right. So I signed it. Then they took us, many of us, you know, to another sitting area. We sat there for another, close to maybe 2 hours or so. Now, this one young guy who was with me, he's a young soldier, and he was holding on to my arm really tight. And I said, look, could you please let go? I mean, I'm not going to run anywhere. So he let go my arms, and then he said, he opened up my cuffs, and he said, I'm only going to open this if you're going to behave yourself. I said, yeah, sure, I'll behave myself. So he opened up my cuffs. After about 2 hours, they told us to get up, took us outside, and put us in a prison bus. Next thing I knew, at this point, I hadn't slept for 2 days. As soon as I got in the bus, I fell asleep. I woke up. Next thing I knew, I was in a prison. We got out of the prison. We got out of the bus, taken into a main area. This was a common area that had prison cells around. And they basically told us, go inside the prison cell, go to sleep, and we'll talk to you in the morning. They brought in some fruits and vegetables and told us we wanted to eat something. Many of us said we want to see a lawyer, we want to see our embassy. They said we don't know anything. I asked them I wanted to call my family. They said no. And they basically said, you know, go to the cell. So we went into the cell, maybe slept for about 2-3 hours, got up again in the morning, asked the same question. We want to see a lawyer, we want to see our embassy. No response. At about 10 o'clock in the morning, they told everybody to get back into the cells. We went into the cells and they locked the cells. And next thing we knew, we had a group of students, no more than perhaps 18, 19, or 20 girls and boys who came in. And basically, these were trainees of some sort, and they spent the entire day there looking at us, examining us, questioning some of us. And this went on for the whole day, so basically, we were locked in. Later in the afternoon, I heard somebody say, is there somebody here from Canada? So I kind of got up, went to the door, I said, yes, I'm Canadian. And there were 2 people from from the Canadian embassy, and they said, are you Farouk Bernie? And I said, yes. He said, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm here. They said, because they told us they deported you in the morning. And according to what the information they provided us, you've been deported to Canada. Well, I said, I'm still here. They said, well, it's by coincidence that we found you, otherwise we would have not known where you were. And then they showed me Kevin's photograph and said, do you know who this is? Do you know where he is? I said, I have no idea where Kevin is. So then they left, and that was the last time I heard from the Canadian embassy. We stayed locked in for the whole night. 2 o'clock in the morning, they woke us up again and sent all the Turkish people out. So there was a majority of Turkish people. They took all the Turks out. Our understanding was when we got in, being Canadian, American, British, that probably we'd be the first people out. But actually, it was the Turks who went out first. Before that, it was also the Jordanians who went out. The Jordanian ambassador personally came into the prison, made sure all the Jordanians were out. He took with him all the people who did not have diplomatic ties with Israel. So people from Algeria, people from Indonesia, Malaysia, Pakistan, all these people were taken by the Jordanian ambassador. Also, we had people from the ICRC, International Committee of Red Cross. They came in, gave us numbers and things. This is when we started to panic a little bit. We thought we're here for the long haul, you know, given that they're giving us numbers and all that. Anyway, 2 o'clock in the morning, they took out all the Turkish people and the Turkish people left. Early in the morning, then they gathered us all, the remaining people, myself, Canadian, British, you know, Greek, and they all took us together to this one area, and they said, you're going to the airport. I said, okay, fine. Then they put us in the air, in these buses, and they took us to the airport. When we got to the airport, it's actually when we left the prison, it's the first time we saw there was media all around. We reached the airport, there was a lot of media there, there's a lot of press there. They took us right inside the airport, processed us, told people to sign papers. Many people didn't want to do it, got into a... There was even a fight that broke out at the airport. One colleague who was from Ireland actually beat him. His, you know, head was whatever. So basically from there onwards, we went onto the planes. There were 3 Turkish planes. And Turkey had basically said that we want every single person that came on the ship back on these planes. And these 3 planes would not leave until and unless every single nationality... injured, whether they're dead or they're alive, everybody has to be on these planes. So we basically sat on those planes for 12 hours till every single person came. So now when I look and sort of think in retrospect, you know, I think if it wasn't for the Turks, I would still be in Israel.
Me too.
And heaven. So this whole saga went on for another 12 hours. Right after that, you know, we flew. We arrived in Istanbul, and you know, that's again, you know, there were 2 Canadian officials who were there to meet Kevin and I. I didn't know at this point where Kevin and Rifat, the other Canadian, whether they're dead or alive. I kept asking about them. Nobody knew where they were. But apparently, fortunately, Kevin was on the other plane. So when we arrived, I found out that he's alive, Rifat as well. Also, so we were received by the Canadian embassy there, and then thereafter, Qatari embassy was also there to meet me. They had put me up in a hotel room, and I took the next flight to Doha. Now, just very quickly, you know, I've talked about the journey. When we came back, one of the things that we did is the 3 of us, we wrote to Prime Minister Harper, basically saying to him what has happened. You know, why were we treated like this? Why did the Canadian government did not interfere or help us? Or you know, why did Canada did not condemn the attack? We never heard back from anyone. And this letter was published in these newspapers and outlets. Just, you know, talking about education, this is basically the UN Declaration of Human Rights, Article 26, that everyone has the right to education, and this is what we're promoting and pushing for as part of Quora. This is an ongoing thing. You know, the Flotilla incident is one incident. A year and a half ago, we saw what happened at Operation Castlet. Close to 1,400 people were killed. 18 schools were destroyed. 200 schools were damaged. And the name of Quora actually comes from one of the Inerva schools that was in the center of an attack where 4 Asian students died. So we've taken that name from there. education, the state of education in the West Bank in Gaza is you know, we've seen it, we've read about it, and you know, we know what is happening to academics, to young people, where they're not allowed access to education, which is, again, is a very dangerous thing. The situation in Gaza right now in terms of education, classrooms are crowded, there's inadequate supplies, there are damaged schools, and children are malnourished. The blockade regarding education, these are some of the items that are not allowed inside Gaza. So notebooks, glass for windows, pencils, desks, computer parts, construction material for schools. None of this stuff is allowed so far inside Gaza.